This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and from Jerry Lane Chevrolet. 877-217-5757 is your Talk Louisiana number. Your email is talk@talklouisiana.org. Robin Dow is producing, and in a moment we're going to hear from Laura Vincent. She is the person who runs the show for Teach for America in Louisiana. That organization started 32 years ago, and Laura's held her position now for several years, succeeding Michael Tipton, who used to come on with us about once a year. And it's been a while since we talked to Laura. It's been too long, but this is Teacher Appreciation Week. Do want to note that the two candidates we had on the show for the judicial race, Brad Myers and Jordan Faircloth, they had what would be called a barn burner Saturday, the final tally. Brad Myers, 6,073 votes. Jordan Faircloth, 6,071 votes. Two votes separating the two. And, of course, there will be a recount. But you can imagine it doesn't get any closer than that. If somebody had changed their vote, it would be a tie. And that shows that every vote counts. Remember, Franklin Foyle beat Steve Carter a few years ago by four votes in a Senate race. And a few months ago, across the river in Port Allen, a tax for education failed by one vote. So your vote counts. And unfortunately, with 137,000 eligible voters in this particular race, only 9% actually voted. So that is a tragedy, and unfortunate that it is the case. But Brad Myers, 65 years old, is elected to a judgeship. He's had a long career, starting as a federal prosecutor right out of Louisiana State University. And the fact that they were on this show might have made a difference. Patrick in Innisfil Estates, who calls us every now and then, says, on April 22nd, he sent me this message. After listening to both interviews, I will be voting for Brad Myers for district judge. Of course, he said, I already voted for him in the primary, but he said, I heard them both on the show, and it confirms why I'm supporting Brad. He has the experience, and Mr. Faircloth will probably be back on a ballot sometime soon. He's only 40 years old. I did talk last night with my friends Esther and Victor Saxe, and they told me that they voted for Brad Myers, as did their daughter, Laura. And if they had voted the other way or had not voted at all, then Jordan Faircloth would be the judge. And it is good that, at least at this point, I don't hear a lot of wailing about election fraud, election fraud, election fraud. Imagine if the 45th American president lost a race by two votes. And remember, in 2000, Albert Arnold Gore lost a presidential election by one vote. The U.S. Supreme Court voted 5-4 to stop a recount in Florida, which would have given Gore the victory over George Bush. So Albert Gore, who was the vice president at the time, affirmed his defeat, and he did so quite elegantly. And hopefully we'll have more of that and less of this wailing and lying about election fraud that has been going on now for a few years. With that said, 877-217-5757 for Laura Vincent, graduate of LSU. Grew up in Arlington, Texas, and came this way, and you stayed. You must like it here.
Baton Rouge has truly become a great home for me and my family, both as a former educator in this community and an LSU student. I just can't say enough about how much I love this place and consider it home now, truly.
And I'm already getting an email here from a listener who says only 12,000 people voted in the judicial race, and you're making a big deal about it, Jim, but well over 100,000 people went to the Garth Brooks concert, and you haven't said a word about that. Well, here we go. Did you go?
I was there. You were there? It was a wonderful concert. It was a great show. And, you know, we're wrapping up a big weekend in Baton Rouge and then flowing right into a big week nationally. It's Teacher Appreciation Week across the country.
Well, I'm sure there were more than a few teachers in the stands at Tiger Stadium and on the floor of the arena. And I'm glad that we had something to smile about in Baton Rouge. We've had some hard knocks lately, and this was a good thing for our city. But your organization's been around 32 years, and we've talked about the genesis of Teach for America, started by Wendy Kopp. It's interesting how it started.
It really is. You know, Wendy Kopp wrote her senior thesis at Princeton University on this concept. Might we be able to attract exceptional, diverse leaders who had not considered education maybe as their career pathway into the classroom to teach for at least 2 years in a low-income community? And today, 65,000 people across the country have engaged in Teach for America, either are working in classrooms or are one of our many alumni across the country.
And Teach for America people in Baton Rouge, they generally, they're not at Episcopal or U High.
We're working in all public school systems across the city. So we partner with 5 districts here in the Capital Region. And we have over 320 people who are either active core members in their first or second year of teaching or are alumni of our program and have stayed in Louisiana beyond their initial commitment.
And you're one of those.
I'm one of them. I taught second and third grade right here in Baton Rouge.
What attracted you to Teach for America, Laura?
My first and second grade teachers really changed my life. I often reflect on just the impact they had on my education, the possibilities that they opened up for what I might go on to do in my future. And I was really thinking about that impact when I was spending some time volunteering in public schools in Louisiana and thought, you know, this is a really worthy cause worth spending time, effort, and energy on.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. This is an organization that is quite worthy, and a lot of these people who are affiliated, they come from Ivy League schools. I remember back in the early 90s, some of them came to Baton Rouge, and they were teaching at places you wouldn't expect kids with Ivy League pedigree to be, but they were doing it and seemed to be quite confident that they were making a mark, doing good things for society. How many of them move on to other things as opposed to teaching? Do most do it and then move on and do something else?
This experience, you know, working with students, getting very proximate to the issues facing our education system really changes the trajectory of our core members' careers. And so 80% of them will actually end up remaining in education, either working directly in a school or working for a nonprofit program that impacts students like the Baton Rouge Youth Coalition here locally that was started by Teach for America alumni. So on the whole, 80% of them will remain working in education when only about 10% enter into our program thinking that education would be where they spend their career.
Are there places where Teach for America is more prominent than in others? Like in Louisiana, what is the hot spot, if there is one, for Teach for America?
We're predominantly working in the New Orleans area, Baton Rouge, Pointe Coupee, East Feliciana, and in Donaldsonville.
What about New Orleans?
Very heavy presence in New Orleans, yes.
Very heavy. Okay. 877-217-5757. And how does Louisiana compare with other states? Do you know?
We are one region. We have 2 regions here in Louisiana. So South Louisiana, which is the capital region, and then New Orleans. And there's a really wide range of how many participants are joining our program in each of our 41 regions across the country. We know that Baton Rouge and New Orleans are a really remarkable place to live, and we are working our hardest to get the word out about the opportunities that are here to make an impact in the lives of students and in our school systems overall in Louisiana.
Nancy in St. Gabriel. Nancy, you're on Talk Louisiana with Laura Vincent.
Thank you. Thank you. Good morning to both of you. I just want to know, is there research to compare Teach for America education outcomes regarding students versus teachers coming out of traditional programs in terms of student growth, student achievement growth from year to year?
That's an excellent question. Yes, we measure the impact of our core members in a couple of different ways. First, we ask principals that we partner with how effective our teachers are at delivering instruction and improving student outcomes. And 100% of our partner principals say that Teach for America educators are effective at delivering instruction. And then nationally, we've conducted several peer-reviewed research studies that demonstrate the impact of Teach for America core members having several additional months' worth of additional instruction with the students that they're serving.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on with Laura. Good morning, sir.
Good Good morning. And yes, my question is, it seems that there's so much that teachers have to go through for years and years and years to qualify and to become, because it is such a big job to be doing. And in the fairness of it, there's just so much demanded of them, and then
right. What's your question,
not
Phil?
That much security. My question is in those years, it's like to get some more security for our teachers, because it seems like they have to really, really, so much asked of them. And
all right, what about security for teachers? Is that a big issue?
I wasn't sure if he was asking about job security or just the demands
safety,
of the profession.
Safety of them, I think he's talking about both.
I think that the demand for incredible teacher talent is so high across the state that you see districts taking on really innovative work to both better compensate and better support teachers.
We'll pick up on that when we return with Laura Vincent after this time out. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow is producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. Another segment with Laura Vincent. She is the person who runs the show. She has the title Executive Director, Teach for America, South Louisiana, graduate of LSU, and she practices what she preaches. She was a member of Teach for America on the ground. Can you reveal which school you were involved with?
Elementary and Scotlandville Elementary.
Please repeat that. Your microphone wasn't on. Please.
North Highlands Elementary and Scotlandville Elementary here in Baton Rouge.
Very good. Now, as far as the safety of teachers, and I think that may be what Phil was partly alluding to, some of these places are, of course, they're considered tough schools, whatever that means. Do you have any issues or problems, challenges with teachers and their personal safety?
I have not personally experienced that, and I have not heard our core members feeling concerned for their immediate safety. And I would say the question is a good one, in that we need to be sure we're doing all that we can to protect students, teachers, and communities overall.
877-217-5757 is your number. And a listener asks about the disparity. Right now, Louisiana teachers, I think, make about $51,000 a year, and the southern regional average is $55,000. And we, of course, would like to hit that goal. How are Teach for America participants compensated?
They're compensated at the same level of any other beginning teacher in their district. And this point is such a good one. As we're in Teacher Appreciation Week, we know there are many events happening around the community to show value and care to our teachers. And I'll be glad to share a little bit about that in a second. And we need to be sure we're appreciating them through compensating them well, and thinking about the policies that really support the profession. And so I really appreciate that note. It is an issue that we have to be undertaking as a state.
Do teachers in Louisiana, for example, earn the same at Capital High School as they do at Episcopal?
There are wide ranges in compensation between schools, different types of schools, and districts themselves. And so overall, as a state, we should really be focused on getting that average increased.
Well, I think we should do better. And teachers are the corn seed for everything else. It all comes down to education and family. And without adequate education and a good family concept, people are going to have issues in life, most likely. It's hard not to get ahead when you don't have that in the formative years. In Baton Rouge, how are we doing?
As far as preparing our students well?
Mm-hmm.
One thing we are thinking a lot about is the role of literacy. And as a whole in Louisiana, you know that literacy is becoming a topic that we're paying a lot of attention to. A student who is not proficient in reading by the time they're a third grader is 4 to 6 times more likely to not graduate from high school. And we know how important high school graduation is to a student's life prospects. And so at Teach for America, and specifically in South Louisiana and the Capital Region, we are really beginning to focus more and more of our efforts on improving those literacy rates. Because in May of 2021, in the students in the communities where we work, only 32% of them at third grade were reading proficiently. And we think that that is an issue worth putting a lot of capacity and energy around.
What about dropout rates in Louisiana? Those are high, too. And if you're not literate, you're not going to do well in school. At least you shouldn't do well. You need there's some basics required, as we know. But we have many kids who they not only don't get college degrees, they don't get high school degrees. They don't even get out of elementary school sometimes. How can we address that?
We think one of the best ways into addressing this is what I was just speaking to, is improving literacy rates and ensuring that we have strong early childhood education in place. And as a state, Louisiana is making a lot of moves towards improving that work. And we have a long way to go, too. This is a very complex systemic issue, and we know it will take many coalitions of people working together over a sustained period of time to really get where we need to be so that all students are able to thrive and live a life of their choosing.
All right. And this goes, question from Matt on Jefferson goes right to the heart of teacher safety. There have been some calling for teachers to have weapons on their person. Would you be in favor of that?
I will speak personally that I do not know that equipping teachers with weapons is the solution. Certainly it would not be the only solution to improve safety in schools. I think that we need to ensure that teachers are able to do their roles that they were trained for as professionals, to deliver strong academic content, to build great relationships with students, and thinking about them as the solution for safety is probably not what I might be recommending, Jim.
Well, yeah, I don't think we should have shooting galleries in classrooms, but unfortunately we have had, as we know, some terrible incidents of mass shootings in places, and some believe that if teachers had weapons and were trained to use them, that we might be able to avert those. That's easier said than done, but it is a legitimate thought and a legitimate concern. And teachers, quite like law enforcement officers, they put their lives on the line every day. Every day.
And this is why we should be truly valuing the profession and thinking about how we can compensate them for the work that they're taking on every day.
Well, what is life like day-to-day for a teacher? What is the average day for a teacher in East Baton Rouge Parish right now?
Waking up very early.
Like what time?
Oh, gosh. It depends on what your commute is, what your travel is. But I would say most of our educators are waking up 5:36, taking care of their own families, preparing, you know, their own families or children to go off to school, and then making sure they're there to welcome their students. Many of our educators are staying long after the last bell rings. Maybe they're coaching a sports team. Maybe they're leading a student organization or club. And then they're thinking about how to prepare for the next day, getting their lesson plans, materials ready, contacting parents and families to talk about the day. So it really is a long day.
It's more than an eight-hour day.
It is much more than an eight-hour day, Jim.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org if you'd like to get under the wire with Laura Vincent, the Executive Director of Teach for America, South Louisiana, Tim and Thibodeau. Hi, Tim. You're on Talk Louisiana. Hi, Tim. Good morning, sir.
Is the MAT degree still available at schools such as LSU and so on?
I think you might have been cut off there at the beginning. What degree are you talking about, Tim?
The Master of Arts in Teaching, the MAT.
Okay.
I'm not quite sure exactly which universities are continuing to offer an MAT, but the Master's in Education programs are very much still available across the state.
Daniel in Central. Daniel, good morning, Daniel. You're on Talk Louisiana with Laura Vincent. Hi, Daniel.
Hey, my name is Daniel. I'm a classmate of Laura's from back at LSU a long time ago and a semi-colleague of hers out in Central Community Schools. And I just want to tell her that, Laura, you're doing a great job. We really appreciate it, appreciate everything you do with Teach for America, and y'all really are making a huge difference in our communities.
Thank you, Daniel. It's so nice to hear your voice on the line.
How do you recruit people for Teach for America?
We recruit at over 400 colleges and universities across the country. We sit down with college students and talk to them about the opportunity to join our work. Just this past weekend, we had several of those students who are considering joining our program with us in Baton Rouge. What a weekend for them to be here. Many of them coming to Louisiana for the very first time in their lives. And many times we bring them into a school, into a classroom, and show them what the opportunity might be for them to step into the shoes of an educator.
Who recruited you?
Oh, you brought up Michael Tipton. Michael Tipton and I sat down at the LSU Student Union back in 2007. He was teaching in New York at the time. Michelle Gigg, former LSU student body president, was teaching the year ahead of me at North Highlands Elementary. And then I also had the opportunity to hear directly from our founder, Wendy Kopp. She came to the Manship School.
You actually got a visit from the top person.
I did.
That's wonderful.
And that made it clear to me that this was the work for me.
Let's try to slide Stacy in. Stacy in East Baton Rouge Parish and Brulee. Good morning, Stacy.
Hi. I was calling particularly about special education and literacy. It seems to be something that's not really focused on, and I know that you just said it's so important for that, for their education for the future. I was hoping.
All right. Let's get Laura to respond. Thank you, Stacy. To Stacy's inquiry about special education when we return. We'll be back and we'll have more, a few minutes more with Laura after this. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. In just a moment, we'll hear from Kevin Jamison, the founder and president of the Dementia Society of America. We're finishing up with Laura Vincent, who is executive director of Teach for America South Louisiana. When we went to the break, Stacy in Brulee asked about special education. Are you involved in that at all?
Stacy, we know that to get to this goal of ultimately every student being able to graduate from high school and live a life of their choosing, we know that we have to be sure we're supporting all students, and especially students who need accommodations. And that work of training teachers well in special education is part of the work that we do. And as a state, we recognize that it is an area where we need to continue to improve as well. And Jim, before we wrap, I'm just going to go ahead and name that again, everyone. It is Teacher Appreciation Week. We know that teachers are working incredibly hard in classrooms across the country and right here in Louisiana, and would offer that Teach 225, and you can learn more about them at teach225.com, which was started by Emily LeBeau, a Teach for America alum, a former teacher, a former principal, has created and developed a very special week of events for educators right here in Baton Rouge, which will culminate with a celebration at Perkins Row on Friday. So we invite all educators to participate in that day. Also, all CC's coffee houses across Baton Rouge are offering free coffee and tea to educators all day with a teacher ID. So please make sure that you're participating in that. And everyone, I just encourage us to think about the role that educators have played in influencing our lives or your children's lives, and be sure to show some appreciation this week.
Thank you very much. And we're joined now by Kevin Jamison. He is the person who heads the Dementia Society of America. He was the founder. And as we know, this is an affliction that affects far too many Americans. And good morning to you, Kevin.
Hello, Jim. Thanks to you to have me on today.
Well, it's our honor. And as I mentioned, this is a challenge in society that and a listener has already made the observation. I don't know if it's an accurate one, but it's an important one. Is this something that is more prominent now, or are we just living longer and perhaps more aware of it now than before?
It's probably an all of the above answer, but in brief, the first thing to know about dementia is that it's not a disease. And a lot of people don't realize that. They think of dementia as a disease. Some people call it a disease, maybe even some medical professionals. But actually, disease, it's more of a syndrome than it is a disease. And so when we talk about dementia and whether it's affecting people more now versus in the past, it is a combination of things, because a combination of things cause dementia. So Alzheimer's is one cause, but vascular disease, Lewy body, frontotemporal, and there's many, many others, these all can cause what we would refer to as dementia. So I can get into more detail, but that's the short answer to the causes behind it. And then you have to ask yourself, some things are age-related. So yes, we are living longer. So it's more apt to show up in somebody because we're living to 80 or 90. And maybe if in the past 50, 60, 100 years, they might have lived to 50 or 60. Something else would have killed them prior to developing dementia. So in that respect, yes. And then the other issues are environmental, and we're learning more. So we do know that there are modifiable risk factors for dementia. So in some cases, some forms of dementia are actually expected to decrease because we're not smoking as much, we're eating better, and things like that. So there are a lot of factors that go into that answer. But the long, short answer, if you will, is that there are a lot of causes, and then there are a lot of reasons for why things have either increased or decreased over the past 20, 30, 40, 50 years.
We're visiting with Kevin Jameson, the volunteer, founder, president, CEO, and chairman of the Dementia Society of America. And in America, how many people do we think have dementia? Obviously, this is a moving target, but I suspect you have a pretty good idea.
So it is a moving target. And unfortunately, the numbers across the spectrum of all causes of dementia are not well known. It's something that we really continue to strive to figure out. But right now, there are some pretty good numbers around the Alzheimer's cause. So Alzheimer's is one cause, as I mentioned, of dementia. There could be north of 5 or 6 million people in the United States living with an Alzheimer's type dementia, but there are millions living with vascular dementia, Lewy body dementia, frontotemporal dementia. So all in all, it's probably north of 9, maybe more million people living with a type of dementia here in the U.S. right now.
And I've seen a worldwide figure, Kevin, of over 50 million. That might even be low.
Well, the World Health Organization does look at those numbers, and they do a lot of studies. They probably do the most studies in comparing high economic countries with low economic countries in terms of their rates of dementia. And the interesting thing to note is that in high economic countries like the U.S., right now, the World Health Organization looks at the whole of dementia as the second leading cause of death in the United States.
The process from diagnosis to death is what, usually somewhere under 10 years, isn't it?
Well, it really goes back to kind of our core mission to speak about that, because our core mission is to recognize that there are all these types of dementia. It's kind of like an umbrella, right? It's a syndrome that's an umbrella, kind of like the same way that cancer is an umbrella term that we use. And then you've got lung cancer and breast cancer and melanoma and leukemia and so forth. Well, it's not that different from dementia. Dementia, there's the Alzheimer's, the Lewy body, the vascular, and so forth. So when you say what is the life expectancy, quite frankly, Jim, there are some types of dementia. Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease comes to mind right away, that the trajectory of lifespan, although it's a rare condition, is 6 months to a year, whereas an Alzheimer's disease or a vascular dementia might be 8 to 14 years, sometimes longer. It all depends on a lot of factors, because we're all unique, and how we express the dementia is going to be different.
What are the general causes?
So, it goes back again to there are, there's lots of debate right now about what's causing these various diseases and disorders and conditions that express dementia. Remember, dementia, if we just look at a kind of a definition of it, it's a cognitive impairment that is so severe that it affects two or more activities of daily living. So what's an activity of daily living? That's dressing, eating, bathing, toileting, transferring, things like that. So when you look at Alzheimer's disease, you've probably heard of plaques and tangles, right?
Right.
And those plaques and tangles are malformations, so to speak, of the pathology of our brains. So there's a buildup of something called beta amyloid, which is like a sticky residue substance that gets in the way of the neurons connecting to each other to make sense of things. And then you have neuronal death, which are the tangles. That's a misfolded tau protein. And quite frankly, when that happens, the cell is dying. So it's those two things that make up the characteristics of an Alzheimer's disease. And they really don't know all the things that might trigger it. Some look at things like head trauma or environmental conditions, TBIs, concussions. You've also got genetic aspects to certain types of dementia. So the younger onset, Alzheimer's as an example, is more genetically based than anything else. Frontotemporal dementia, which occurs in the front of the brain and the sides of the brain, there are also some genetic components with that. Lewy body dementia, I mentioned once or twice, that's on the Parkinson's spectrum. And again, there are genetic roles, but we don't necessarily know how those get started precisely. But lastly, and I'll mention this one, vascular dementia is a huge issue. And that comes from cardiovascular health. Those issues are more well known because what's good for the heart is good for the brain. So lack of blood flow to the brain through a stroke or oxygen deprivation, all those things can impact our brains.
And the early warning signs, Kevin?
There are a lot of them. We call them the 22 clues, but they can range from personality change, short-term memory loss, an inability to move well, so mobility issues, hallucinations. You've got issues that with executive function that are more, making decisions. But there's a wide range of clues that can help people kind of put their antenna up, Jim, so that they can say, that's not that person's normal or that's not my normal. And maybe it's word finding. Maybe you speak in kind of what they call a word salad, which is kind of a garbled message. So all of these things can happen to somebody. And it's really up to a neurologist or geriatrician or a neuropsychiatrist or another professional to start to delve in and figure that out.
Well, for those who'd like more information from the Dementia Society of America, I know you have some ways where they can retrieve information, Kevin.
Yes, absolutely. So we get, thousands of visitors to our website at dementiasociety.org, and we get a lot of phone calls to 1-800-DEMENTIA. So it's 1-800 and then spell the word dementia, and that will get you to our answers line. And we are...
Okay, we do have to roll, but that's 1-800-DEMENTIA, and we thank Kevin Jameson. We're back with more after this. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757. Trial beginning today regarding whether or not St. George will become part of the fabric of Baton Rouge, meaning of being a separate city, and we'll be following that. And there's much going on. One of the principal architects of that, it was Lionel Rainey, the public relations guru, talented man who also was head of Jordan Faircloth's campaign for judge. And as noted as we started today, Jordan Faircloth lost by the skinniest of margins, 2 votes to Brad Myers with a recount going. So it's been a big week for Mr. Rainey. We're joined now by Matt Richtel, the Pulitzer Prize winner from the New York Times. His latest work is Inspired, Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. And I've been familiar with Matt's work for many years. But Matt, I want to make sure I have the pronunciation of your last name correct. Did I get it right?
You nailed it.
Okay, well, good deal. We're off to a good start. And this is the story of how we create. You opine, and I think accurately, that creativity defines the human experience, sparking achievement, innovation in art, science, technology, business, sports, virtually every activity we're involved with. And quite often we don't talk a lot about it, but you've written a book about it. How did you get to this point?
Well, I got interested in the idea that people think of creativity as belonging to geniuses, and it turns out nothing is further from the truth, that all of us have creativity deep, deep inside of us, and even it's on a biological level, and I wanted to understand what it was and how it feels to tap into it and what we can do as a result.
Now, Americans quite often are touted as the most creative people on the planet. Is that accurate, or are we just thumping our chests over something that we want to believe?
Oh, I think we are exceedingly creative nation, and I'll concede my patriotism here. But I do also think in the same breath, it's creativity is innate. I think one of the things that makes this country particularly creative is you have these enclaves, these areas where people congregate, Hollywood, Silicon Valley, big manufacturing areas in the middle of the country at different areas, Detroit, where big minds come together and they begin to collaborate and cooperate and compete. And there's also a pioneering spirit here. And what pioneering is at its core is pushing the edges of where we have been, manifest destiny. I think that's a big part of our spirit.
The book is Inspired, Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. And creativity affects every facet of our lives. And Matt, I would have to think, based on what you're saying, and it's fairly apparent that environment has a big part of it, but so does biological and evolutionary origins. So can you factor in, what you've studied, what you think on this?
So just a big step back. I went back and looked at all the science about creativity, and I dotted the lines all the way back to what people look at in labs, looking at bacteria and microorganisms to see how they behave when they're put under pressure. And you might say, what the heck does that have to do with creativity? But in Switzerland, in this lab, there's a guy who studies creativity by looking at what happens when you bombard bacteria with antibiotics. And when you put them in a vial, in a petri dish, and bombard these bacteria with basically nuclear weapons, some of them survive. They survive by reproducing and coming up with random mutations that give them defenses against antibiotics. Okay, fast forward. The human species is put under all kinds of pressure, and we come up with alternatives to the way we live and behave and act and do science, and those are analogous to what happens inside that petri dish. We are creativity machines.
We are creativity machines, and quite often we never get to appreciate that. We get bogged down with everyday life. Are there impediments to creativity?
Massive impediments to creativity. So a big part of the science I explore in this book is, so you're out there, you want to be an entrepreneur, you want to be an artist, you want to be a musician, you want to be an architect, you want to be a chef. Go down the list. You get ideas. I'll explain where those ideas come from in a minute. But for a lot of people, before you ever get to those ideas, you run into some real hesitation around whether to pursue them. And I just want to ask you, Jim, have you ever had ideas, and I'll explain where this is, where you go, no, that's not, never going to work, bad idea, don't do it, mm-hmm. Tell your wife, you've had that experience?
Well, I don't have a wife, but I have had those times when I, for one brief shining moment, I thought I was onto something, and then I talked myself out of it, and I think we all do that on occasion.
We all do that. What the science will show is that we say we love creativity, but on a subconscious level, we actually can associate it with things like toxins and poison and vomit. What the heck? Well, here's why. To be creative or to pursue new ideas means challenging the status quo. It means going into an area that may not work, and it may even mean changing how you do things. And so, to really push through with a creative idea requires us to confront the idea that there's some fear associated with it. And I think those people who wind up being very creative are not necessarily people who have the best ideas. I'll tell you an Einstein story in a second about that. It's the people who give themselves freedom to make mistakes. So this one of my favorite stories in this book, although I have a mountain of stories that just put a smile on my face, is Einstein says to a colleague, "Hey, I finally figured out the unified field theory." And Einstein's colleague says, "Well, that's pretty good, Albert, but under that theory, the universe can't exist." And what he was famous for was coming up with lots of ideas. I'll give you one more about Charles Schulz. Years ago, I did a syndicated comic strip, and my editor was the editor of Peanuts. I said, "Tell me about Charles Schulz." She said, "Well, he'd wake up in the morning, and he would say, 'Oh, man, I got an idea for the perfect peanut strip.'" And he'd get about writing, and he'd write in just a thrilled state of mind. And by the end of the day, he'd finish it, wake up the next morning, look at it, and go, no, that wasn't exactly perfect. Wait, I've got an idea for a great comic strip. This is the one." And I think what creators do is they give themselves the freedom and permission to push through that skepticism, even though there's a lot of times it's just not going to work. That's the nature of creativity.
Well, your book is an example. I would suspect there are people who are saying, "You write a book like this, you're not going to find an audience." But it is an important topic, and you made it quite compelling. Did you have some pushback? It is a departure from some of your previous work, too.
It's a big departure for me, and quite the opposite in my case from having pushback. I'm very blessed to have a publisher in HarperCollins that gives me the green light. And you know, it's interesting. If you find people who, friends, spouses, co-workers, who either see something in you or they just want to encourage you, it can go a long way because I didn't know if I could pull this off. And their encouragement sent me, plus some money. But that's not why I did it. If you start doing creativity for money, you're going to get yourself into a tough spot. It's got to come from the heart.
Matt Richtel is the name. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner, born in Los Angeles, went to Cal Berkeley and Columbia School of Journalism, and he also lives in the great city of San Francisco. Some would say you have a bit of an advantage, Matt. You've been around in some of the most creative meccas in the world. Your thoughts?
It's so well put. I started this book in Jerusalem because I thought, well, that's where so much creative energy came from 2,000 years ago. And has helped define how we think about our species. And it turned out that there was a population of 500,000 in Jerusalem at the time. That may not sound like much, but it was big for the day. And what the science will show is if you're in particular areas that have heavy population, where a lot of people are thinking about a given idea, you wind up getting ideas built upon ideas built upon ideas. I would say in this moment in time, and I make the argument in the book, that we are in the most creative period in human history. That is because, owing to technology, you can congregate and compete and collaborate across borders like never before. So if you get an idea in Louisiana and you want to collaborate with someone in Ohio who's an engineer.
All right, we do have to roll, but The book is inspired, Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul from the remarkable Matt Richtel, Pulitzer Prize winner. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support. Stay safe and stay tuned.